A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You know the moment. The interview's winding down. They've asked their last behavioral question, and then it comes, do you have any questions for us? And you do a quick mental triage of your list. Pick the two that won't scare them off, and call it a day. Maybe you ask about culture. Maybe you ask about growth opportunities. Safe questions. Questions that signal interest without rocking the boat. You've been trained to do this since your first career workshop in college. Daniel's prompt this week takes that moment and throws it out the window. He wants to know what happens if you never wait for the invitation. You walk in, and from the opening handshake, you're the one running the show, flipping turn, taking so thoroughly that the interviewer spends the whole time answering your questions, not the other way around. He's asking three things specifically. 1. How do you flip turn-taking from the very start, before the interviewer even settles into their script? 2. How do you persist when they push back or deflect? And 3. This is the one that got me. What interrogative techniques do you deploy when you've already decided you don't want the job, and you're going to use the remaining time to extract intelligence for your next search?
That third one is the part nobody writes about, and I mean nobody. I searched for this. Career advice blogs, LinkedIn thought leaders, even the more aggressive negotiation books, they all stop at make sure the job is right for you. Nobody gives you the playbook for when you've already decided it's not.
Nobody writes about any of this, really. The advice exists in theory, but the practice is almost entirely undocumented. You can find fragments, a blog post here, a LinkedIn thread there, but no one has stitched together the full operational picture. So let's figure out what did it actually take.
Let's start with the foundational problem. The standard career advice, have questions ready at the end, it's a ceiling, not a floor, and it's strategically backward. Ask Kroot cites research showing that 60% of interviewers form their hiring decision within the first 15 minutes. If you're saving your best questions for minute 45, you've already lost the chance to shape how they see you. The decision's been marinating for half an hour.
So the first 15 minutes are when the impression sets, and the standard advice has you nodding along like a supplicant for the entire window where it matters. You're literally performing deference during the exact period when their mental model of you is calcifying.
The core mindset shift that all the sources agree on is moving from, I hope they like me, to, I'm checking whether this is a smart place to spend my skills and time. Jerry Lee at Onsulting frames it as moving from applicant to business expert checking out a possible partner. Kathy Korovec, who's VP of Product at Vercel, says, interviews are a tool to build opinions about a decision you're about to make, not a test you're trying to pass.
That reframing sounds good on paper, but how does it actually feel in the room? Because most people walking into an interview have spent days preparing, they're nervous, their cortisol is spiking. Saying, I'm a business expert checking out a partner, is a nice mantra, but the body doesn't always get the memo.
That's fair. And I think that's why so few people actually do this, even when they intellectually understand the strategy. The physical experience of an interview, the power differential in the room, the fact that they're sitting behind a desk and you're in the guest chair, it's designed to trigger deference. The whole ritual is built around them evaluating you. Breaking out of that isn't just a mental shift, it's almost a physical one. You have to override your own nervous system.
Which makes Daniel's question even more interesting. He's not asking about the confident candidate who naturally commands a room. He's asking about the techniques, the mechanics, the things you can practice and deploy regardless of how you feel.
Right, and the published advice, even the aggressive stuff, stops well short of what Daniel's asking. The closest thing to a candidate commandeering the opening is a hiring manager named Patrick Lambros who wrote about this on LinkedIn. He asks candidates to go first with their questions. But that's employer-initiated. He's handing them the wheel. Daniel's asking about taking it.
And that's a fundamentally different dynamic. One is permission. The other is seizure.
Right. No mainstream source documents a candidate successfully flipping the table from moment one in a standard interview. So we're in uncharted territory. But the techniques exist if you repurpose them from adjacent domains. Socratic questioning, failure mode analysis, elicitation. The question is what the practice looks like.
So what are the actual mechanisms? Let's look at what the research does document and push it to its logical endpoint.
Mechanism 1, the Socratic opening gambit. Owner.io published a piece on this in April, adapting Socratic questioning for technical interviews. Here's how it works. The interviewer opens with, "How would you handle X situation?" Instead of answering, you respond with a clarifying question that reframes the whole dynamic. Before I answer, can I ask, how has the team handled X in the past and what worked or didn't?
That's not evasion. It's a power move dressed as diligence.
It positions you as a problem solver gathering context, not a supplicant proving worth. And it does something structural. It forces the interviewer to reveal information before you reveal anything about yourself. You've inverted the information asymmetry in one sentence.
And if they push back, I'd rather hear your approach first.
That's where persistence comes in. The Wonsulting Guide has a specific follow-up for this. You say, I want to make sure my answer is relevant to your actual situation, not a hypothetical. 30 seconds of context will make my answer twice as useful to you. You framed your demand as a favor to them.
Smooth. But let me push on this. Some interviewers are going to see right through that. They'll recognize it as a deflection, and it'll annoy them. How do you read whether you're dealing with someone who'll respect the move versus someone who'll penalize you for it?
That's where the emotional intelligence piece comes in, and we'll get to that. But I'd argue that even the negative reaction is useful data. If someone gets visibly annoyed that you asked for context before answering a question, what does that tell you about what it's like to work with them? If they can't handle a 30-second detour in an interview, how are they going to handle you pushing back on a technical decision in a real project?
That's a fair point. The reaction is information regardless. What's mechanism two?
Kathy Korovec's signature question, deployed as an opening wedge instead of a closing one. She asks, how will I fail in every interview? She says it always surprised the interviewer and consistently revealed more than any other question. The logic is simple. If the hiring manager hasn't thought about what success looks like and where the blind spots are, that's a major red flag. Now, she deploys this during the interview. But imagine asking it in the first 5 minutes.
Before they've even settled into their evaluation posture.
You walk in, you sit down, they say, tell me about yourself. And you say, I'd love to, but first, I want to understand something. If we're sitting here a year from now and this hire didn't work out, what's the most likely reason why?
That's a pre-mortem. You've just forced them into a defensive posture of justification rather than evaluation. The conversation is now about failure modes, not about whether you can recite star stories. And here's what I find fascinating about this. You've also just signaled something about yourself. You've signaled that you think in terms of risk and failure, that you're not just going to show up and hope for the best. That's actually an attractive trait in a lot of roles.
AskCruit recommends exactly this question as a reverse interview technique. When asked early, it sets the agenda. And here's the thing. If they can't answer it or they get flustered, that's data. That's not you being rude. That's them showing you they haven't thought about what success looks like.
What's mechanism three?
The structural takeover. Scott Sosna documented a real case of this in August. A candidate who walked into an interview that started late and disorganized, acknowledged the disarray, and then simply steered the conversation toward what mattered to them. They didn't wait for permission. They saw the power vacuum and filled it.
An interview that's already off the rails is low-hanging fruit, though. The harder case is the polished on-schedule interview, where the interviewer has their script, and they're sticking to it. The kind where they've got their list of behavioral questions printed out, and they're checking them off one by one.
That's where the example demand becomes your primary tool. When the interviewer says, "We have a great culture," you don't nod. You say, "Can you give me an example of those words in action?" When they say, "We wear many hats," you say, "That sounds exciting. Can you help me understand the core responsibilities versus the extra hats? I want to make sure I can prioritize effectively."
I love the translation follow-up. You're not rejecting their framing. You're enthusiastically embracing it and demanding specifics. You're saying, "I love that. Tell me more," instead of, "I don't believe you. Prove it." The emotional valence is completely different.
Jerry Lee at Wonsulting built an entire translation guide for corporate speak. "We're like a family" means we lack professional boundaries. Unlimited PTO is often a trap where people take less time off. Ask Kroot flags the same thing. The point isn't just to decode the euphemisms, it's that demanding examples is the only way to cut through them. And if the interviewer gets defensive or vague when you ask, that's not you being rude, that's them showing you a red flag.
So defensiveness itself is data. You don't need to interpret it, you just need to notice it. If you ask for an example and they get weird, the content of their answer barely matters. The fact that they got weird is the answer.
And that brings us to the escalation. Those techniques work when you want the job. But what about when you've decided you don't?
This is the part Daniel was clearly most interested in. The scorched earth intelligence extraction. And I want to pause on the psychology of this for a second, because it's such a strange mental state to be in. You're sitting in a room with someone, you've already decided this isn't happening, and now you have a choice. You can coast through the rest of the interview, give polite answers, and leave. Or you can treat the remaining time as an asset to be exploited. Most people coast. Daniel's asking about the alternative.
And it's the least documented angle in mainstream career advice. No source explicitly endorses burning the bridge for intelligence, but the techniques exist if you repurpose them.
Walk me through them.
Technique 1, the bus factor question. From Wonsulting, what's the average tenure of someone on this specific team? If everyone has been there less than 6 months, that's a turnover factory, but the intelligence value goes beyond this one company. You're building a mental map of which organizations are bleeding talent, which roles are toxic, what patterns to look for in future interviews. You're not just evaluating this job, you're calibrating your radar.
And you can ask that question with a straight face whether you want the job or not. It sounds like due diligence. Nobody's going to flag how long do people stay as an aggressive question. It's practically expected.
Technique 2, the competitive threat question. What's the company's biggest competitive threat right now, and how is this team helping to mitigate it? This extracts strategic intelligence about the market landscape. You learn who's winning, who's scared, where the industry is heading. That's useful whether you're joining this company or their competitor.
And if you've already decided you're out, you can push harder on the follow-ups. When you say they're a threat, what specifically are they doing that you can't match? You'd never ask that if you wanted the offer. That question has an edge to it. It implies you've noticed a weakness, and you're curious how deep it goes.
Technique 3, the failed project autopsy. Ask Kroot recommends asking about the last project that failed and how management reacted. But when you don't care about burning the bridge, you can go deeper. What happened to the team involved? Were there consequences? Did anyone leave? You're not just learning how this company handles failure. You're learning about blame patterns, scapegoating, whether failure is career-ending here. Those patterns apply across the industry. If you know that Company X fires the team lead when a project fails, and Company Y does a blameless post-mortem, that tells you something about where you want to work.
And Technique 4, you mentioned a back-channel compounding loop?
The Fishman AF newsletter described this. You use reverse interviews to gather intelligence that feeds into back-channel reference checks with former employees. You extract information during the interview, then use that information to validate or challenge what former employees tell you. Each interview becomes a data collection node in a larger intelligence network. You ask the hiring manager about a failed project, they give you the sanitized version, and then you find a former employee on LinkedIn and say, "I heard about the Project Phoenix situation. What really happened?"
That's sophisticated. And it requires a network. You can't do this if you don't already have connections in the industry, which means the technique is self-reinforcing. The more you use it, the more effective it becomes, because each interview builds your network and your intelligence base for the next one.
Which brings us to the uncomfortable part. Your Career Place published a piece on reverse interviews this year that directly addresses what they call the privilege problem. The reverse interview requires hours of research, confidence, social capital, back-channel networks. And we're in what economists are calling a hiring recession. Low job growth, high competition, declining openings, even as applicants per role surge. Candidates who can't afford reverse recruiters at $900 to $2,500 a month, or flat fees up to $15,000 for executive-level support, they're left behind.
So the technique that empowers some candidates is stratifying the market for others. The people who can afford to walk into an interview and treat it like an intelligence operation are the people who don't desperately need that specific job. and the people who desperately need the job can't risk any of this.
That's the uncomfortable underbelly of this entire premise. The candidate who walks in and flips the table is already operating from a position of privilege. They have options. They have research time. They have the social capital to risk burning a bridge. The candidate who desperately needs this job can't afford any of these techniques. They have to play it safe. They have to be the supplicant.
There's also the arms race problem. Just as candidates learn to game traditional interviews with star method answers, interviewers are learning to give scripted responses to common reverse interview questions. How long before the playbook catches up?
And some companies now have policies about what interviewers can disclose. The Ask Group Guide warns about this implicitly. They're teaching candidates to spot the scripts. Unlimited PTO is a trap. We're like a family is a warning sign. But the scripts are getting better. The cat and mouse escalation means the most effective reverse interview techniques are the ones that can't be scripted. The failure mode questions, the Socratic follow-ups, the specific demands for examples. You can't pre-write an answer to, what's the most likely reason I'd fail here? Because it forces genuine reflection.
Unless they've been trained to give a rehearsed answer to exactly that question. Give it 18 months and how will I fail? We'll have a scripted response in every Fortune 500 interview playbook. Some VP of HR is going to circulate a memo. Expect the pre-mortem question. Here's your talking points.
Probably. The arms race never stops, which means the frontier is techniques that can't be reduced to a script. Reading the room, adapting in real time, using emotional intelligence as a tactical tool. The thing that makes Korvec's question powerful isn't the words. It's that she deploys it when the interviewer isn't expecting it, and she reads the response in real time.
So the technique isn't the question. It's the timing and the follow-up.
And that's harder to train against. You can script an answer to, how will I fail, but you can't script an answer to the third follow-up question that digs into the contradiction in your first two answers. At some point, the script breaks and you're just having a conversation. And the person who's better at having that conversation wins.
Before we get too deep into the theory, I want to hear from someone who's actually sat on the other side of this. Hilbert, you've been quiet. What do you have?
1989. I was doing corporate recruiting for a defense contractor. Not by choice. I'd followed a woman to Maryland and it didn't work out, but the job stuck. We had a candidate come in for a systems engineering role. She sat down, opened a leather portfolio, and before I could ask my first question, she said, I've reviewed your last three quarters of SEC filings, and I have some questions about the revenue concentration risk. How dependent is this division on the Trident contract?
She opened with that.
I'd never seen it before. I'd been recruiting for 6 years at that point, and nobody had ever opened an interview by asking about a specific government contract by name. I answered. I didn't know what else to do, and she wrote down my answer. Not mental notes, actual notes on a legal pad. She had a list. She went down the list for 40 minutes. I never asked her a single question.
Did she get the job?
She wasn't there for the job. I found out later she was a consultant doing competitive intelligence for one of our subcontractors. She was going to interviews across the defense industry, extracting information about contract structures and team compositions, and selling the analysis back to clients. She'd done 14 of these.
That's the end point of the technique. It's corporate espionage dressed as a job interview.
And it's why some companies now have policies about what interviewers can disclose. After that, our legal team instituted a rule. No discussing contract values, no discussing team headcounts, no discussing competitor relationships during interviews. If a candidate asked, we were trained to say, I can't speak to that in detail at this stage. It changed how we ran every interview.
The arms race has been running longer than I realized. You're talking about 1989.
The techniques change. The dynamic doesn't. There's always someone who figures out they can extract more than they're supposed to. The woman with the legal pad, she wasn't doing anything illegal, technically. She was just using an interview for something it wasn't designed for. The system assumes good faith on both sides. Once one side stops operating in good faith, the whole thing breaks down.
Now we're talking about candidates doing this at scale. Not just one consultant with a legal pad, but a whole class of job seekers who've read the playbook and are treating every interview as an intelligence-gathering opportunity.
The back-channel thing you mentioned earlier, that's exactly what she was doing, just without LinkedIn. She'd do the interview, extract what she could, then cross-reference it with other interviews and public filings. By the time she talked to a client, she had a more complete picture of the competitive landscape than most of the companies she was analyzing.
Did she ever get caught?
Someone at one of the other contractors recognized her at a third interview and mentioned it to their recruiter. Word got around. She stopped getting interviews. But by then, she'd built enough of a reputation that she didn't need them anymore. Companies hired her directly for the analysis. She'd turned the interviews into a product.
That's almost admirable. In a horrifying way.
She sent me a Christmas card for 3 years. I never figured out how she got my home address.
Where does this leave us? The techniques are real. They work, and they're escalating on both sides. The question Daniel's prompt leaves hanging is what happens to the interview as a social ritual if this becomes standard practice.
If every candidate walks in treating the interview as an adversarial intelligence extraction, the whole thing collapses. Companies stop disclosing anything. Interviews become even more scripted than they already are. The information asymmetry just moves to a different layer. Back channels, informal networks, the things that can't be regulated by HR policy.
That advantages the people who already have networks. Which circles back to the privilege problem. The people who win in a world of back-channel intelligence are the people who already know people. Everyone else is stuck with whatever the company chooses to disclose in the scripted interview, which will be nothing.
The alternative is that it evolves into something more collaborative. If both sides show up expecting a real two-way exchange, not an evaluation ritual, maybe the interview becomes a genuine negotiation between equals. Patrick Lambros's approach, asking candidates to go first, that's a step in that direction. It's the employer acknowledging that they should be evaluated too.
But that requires the employer to initiate. Daniel's asking about the candidate seizing the initiative, and the most extreme version of that, the scorched earth intelligence extraction. It's inherently adversarial. You can't build a collaborative norm on a foundation of, I've already decided I don't want this job. Now tell me about your competitive vulnerabilities.
No, you can't. But the less extreme versions, the Socratic opening, the failure mode questions, the demand for examples, those could become standard practice without breaking the system. They're just good due diligence. The question is whether the norm settles at candidates ask good questions throughout or escalates to candidates treat every interview as an intelligence operation.
I think the answer depends on how desperate the market is. In a hiring recession, candidates with leverage get more aggressive and candidates without leverage get more desperate. The techniques Daniel's asking about, therefore people with leverage. And right now, leverage is concentrated.
The ones who need them most can't use them.
That's the uncomfortable truth sitting underneath this whole discussion. The reverse interview is powerful, but it's not universally available. The question isn't whether you should have questions ready. The question is whether you're willing to walk in treating the interview as your investigation, not theirs. And if you are, what are you willing to learn, and what are you willing to risk?
The arms race is accelerating either way. The most effective techniques today will be scripted against tomorrow. The next frontier is probably techniques that can't be scripted at all. Reading the room, adapting in real time, using emotional intelligence as a tactical tool. The candidate who can do that will always have an edge, regardless of what's in the corporate playbook.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing, and for the story about the woman with the legal pad. I'm going to be thinking about that one for a while. The Christmas card detail especially.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to send us your own questions, job interviews, corporate espionage, or otherwise, email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon. And if you're a hiring manager listening to this, maybe think about what you'd say if someone asked you how they'd fail in the first 5 minutes, because that question is coming.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head,
send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird props, that's the close from slot, from man, from long ear host. My weird props, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.